Zoom a little zoom in a rocket ship. Off we go on a trip. Heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zoom into the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha, 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hi, everyone. This is my science project for March 6th, 2008. I am your Vancouver host, Anne. We've got a lot of good stuff lined up for today, so stick with us. Not only will we have an interview with Jennifer Gardy, one of UBC's finest postdocs, who's landed herself a job as a television host for a new CBC science program, but we'll also take a look at how women use and process language. We're kind of focusing on some ladies' stories this week, because tomorrow is International Women's Day, and there'll be a lot of women's programming here at CITR. So that'll definitely be worth checking out. We're going to get things warmed up the day before Women's Day with our own dose. For obvious reasons, we're kind of in favor of that angle of story. And also, as usual, we want to get things started with an animal story. Always love a good animal story here at my science project. And today, if you were to ask me what's new, I'd answer with this animal story. And the reason why is because the hexapus is new. In England, recently, staff from the Blackpool Sea Life Centre in northwest England picked up Henry the hexapus off the north coast of Wales. Henry was discovered in a lobster pool and, as his name suggests, may be the first six-legged octopus ever identified. Adding hexa, meaning six, to puss, you get hexapus, and that gives Henry his logical name. No other record or rumor of a hexapus has ever turned up before, despite extensive conversations, networking, and research by the people of the Blackpool Sea Life Centre. And the aquarium believes that the absence of two legs in Henry the hexapus was likely caused by a birth defect. Octopuses are most often famous for having eight legs, but they're also famous for having three hearts, and they're famous for having blue blood. But Henry, he got six legs, and he will be on display in Blackpool later this month. So I just mentioned a moment ago that we've got a lot of stories related to women and women in science and science of women. And so I'll just start things off in sort of a traditional sense. I think I did this last year in honor of International Women's Day, and that is to play Freeze Pop's fabulous song, Science Genius Girl.
I'm a science genius girl. I want the science fair. I wear a white lab coat. Me and this strands in my hair. Scientific method girl, the theorems speak to me. Microscope is in my hand. Times one, times two, times three. When I clone a human being, it will want to hold my hand. When I clone a human being, it will be a member of my band.
You mean me?
measure out the chemicals. Safety goggles on my eyes. Turn the Bunsen burner on. My creation comes alive. I have hope for humanity. It is here and holds my hand. I have hope for humanity. It is now a member of my band. It is now a member of my band. It is now a member of my band. I have grown a human being. It is new and rocks my hand. I have grown a human being. It is now a member of my band.
That was Freeze Pop with Science Genius Girl, a personal favorite for obvious reasons, and certainly a song that should get you in the mood for International Women's Day tomorrow. As I mentioned before, CBC has a new science show, and it's called Project X. It made its 30-minute debut on February 14th with an episode on flight. And subsequent episodes have riffed on the theme of body armor, from animal hides to bulletproof vests, and on the theme of invaders, from zebra mussels in our lakes to parasitic worms in our bodies. The show is hosted by biologist Brian Alters, engineers Dr. Brian Fleck and his grad student Mark Hewitt, and by UBC's own Dr. Jennifer Gardy. Jennifer Gardy is a postdoctoral researcher in Bob Hancock's lab in the Department of Microbiology here at UBC. She did her PhD over at SFU. And I had a chance to chat with her earlier this week, and I can definitely say that after chatting with her for about half an hour the other day, it's clear that she's wanted to be on TV as long as she can remember. And as a host of Project X, Jennifer has managed to spin her passions for performance and science into what amounts to her dream job. With so few science programs in Canada, I took the chance straight away to find out how she landed this gig. And this is what she told me.
Into hammering around and being just a total attention hog. We used to have this in our house. There was the living room. It was kind of a sunken living room, and the foyer was right up the stairs from that, and it had this perfect archway. It was like a natural stage. So my parents would be hosting dinner parties and having grown-up time, and I'd suddenly like barge in and make a grand entrance and start dancing or singing or doing something ridiculous. So I'd always been really interested in performing arts and doing something to be on stage and be the center of attention. But then I also have this very practical side of my personality that realized that it's very difficult to make a living in that world, and that you should always have a backup career. And I really enjoyed science, and I really enjoyed things like English and performing arts when I was in school, but I always kind of emphasized the science aspect of things, rationalizing that you could do things like work for a newspaper, do poetry, do dance in your spare time or as a hobby, but you can't really do that with a lot of science. Like, you can't just go into your garage and sequence a genome. So I figured I would take the courses and the thing that was a little more tricky to do and leave all the fun stuff for just a hobby. So I started doing a lot of things like working for the UBC newspaper when I was an undergraduate, working for a couple other papers on campus and around, doing things like a little bit of journal writing here or article writing here and there, but mostly just having fun and being around all those people. And as I kept on going with school, it was something I always stayed in touch with, so it sort of moved from the performing arts to the writing and the publication arts at that point. And then realized eventually that you could parlay that back into performing arts. If you're a journalist, it's not a tremendously huge step to go from print media to television media. So I was doing a lot of science writing. When I had come back from, I went to Montreal for a little while to do a graduate diploma there. I guess that was around 2000. And I worked at the Montreal Gazette when I was there for a year and a half, so I got some really mainstream media experience there. And when I came back to Simon Fraser University, where I did my PhD, I got involved in writing science articles for the SFU newspaper. They just needed the media and PR department's kind of official paper as opposed to the student one. They needed somebody that could go in and talk to the professors and understand what they were saying and then translate that back into stuff that their readership could make sense of. So I did that for a while and yeah, eventually decided to have a go at the television thing.
You make it sound like you can just sort of walk into it.
Pretty much.
Did it work out that easily for you?
It did work out that easily, cool. Actually. I'd always sort of kept my eye out for opportunities, auditions and things. I mean, just stupid stuff like looking at some of the Craigslist boards to see if anybody was just doing a general hosting call. And you do find things that way. They're few and far between, but they do pop up. And also, I was sort of peripherally involved with Let's Talk Science, and they're somebody that often gets asked by producers, production companies, you know, do you know anybody that might be interested in hosting this show? So just through looking around of my own and being in peripheral contact with some science communication groups, I managed to pick up a few auditions, and that was for stuff that never actually ended up going ahead into anything, so kind of stalled. But then when I was, actually, I had a really great conversation one day with Mark Winston at SFU. He's a great science communication sort of guru. He studies bees, well, used to study bees. He's now moved entirely into science communication and dialogue. But he was a great guy to talk to, really inspirational, gave me lots of good ideas about how to really pursue science communication as less of a hobby and more of a future career. And he had told me about the Banff Center, and they were doing the science communications workshop for the first time in 2006, and he was one of the faculty that was involved in organizing it. And at this time, I think this was about like 2004, it was just in the earliest seeds of this program coming to life. So I kept my eye on it, and then as soon as the application deadline popped up, applied for that, went to that, and it had just the time of my life. It was totally transformative. And so while I was there, it was being hosted by Jay from the Daily Planet, Jay Ingram. And he hooked me up with an audition for Daily Planet, which was really good. As obviously, I'm not the new host of Daily Planet, but it was still a great experience. And I got a really good audition tape out of it and met a lot of TV people there that said, you know, I would have stopped this if somebody said, look, you're never going to be on TV, you're really crappy at this. But they all said, like, you know, you've definitely got a little nugget of natural talent in there somewhere, so it's worth pursuing and trying to build on. So armed with this audition tape that I had, that they had all said was quite good, I got a notice about CBC looking for hosts for this program, dropped the DVD in the mail, like literally within 5 seconds of getting the note, and yeah, got to them the next day, and I got a call the day after that saying we'd like to come out and see you in Vancouver along with a couple other people. So really, I mean, if you just doggedly pursue whatever it is you want to do, and you've got a little bit of natural talent and a lot of stick-to-it-ness. Basically,
you've just been listening to Jennifer Gardy as she chatted about how she made her way from the lab into the limelight as a presenter on CBC's Project X, a new science magazine show that's on Thursday nights, actually. It'll be on television this evening if you want to check that out. When we come back, we'll hear a little bit more about some of the upcoming projects on Project X. But we're going to take a little break right now for some music. This is Float On by Modest Mouse.
Float on, okay. We'll float on, okay. And we'll all float. This is beautiful downtown Burbank.
Well, Max, headquarters. Headquarters. Chaos.
An audio magazine to be read with the ear.
Thursday nights at 11.
I saw the sign, so I removed the other eye.
Laugh Tracks, a show about comedy.
A cheerful change from the humdrum morning fair.
We didn't come from monkeys, you atheistic pinko meathead.
Mr. President, hey, oh, yay!
Thank you, Mr. Bale.
Every Thursday night on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
I'm beginning to feel like a nut.
That's small.
Yeah.
If you're a film addict, a festival addict, or an art addict, then we've got the place for you to be. It's the Vancouver Student Film Festival.
What makes this festival different from any other is that it's all about students, and of course, their films. You'll get to see the work made by some of the people who'll be ruling the industry in the near future.
The concept behind the festival is to promote the already vibrant community of young Canadian filmmakers in British Columbia by showcasing the films of students and recent graduates from post-secondary film institutions, and thus enhancing the lines of communication that currently exist between the artist, the public, and fellow colleagues on the West Coast.
The third annual Vancouver Student Film Festival will take place on Saturday, May 24th, 2008 at the VIFC Van City Theatre. For more info, please visit the website at www.vsff.com.
Welcome back to My Science Project. This is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And just before the musical interlude, you were listening to an interview with Jennifer Gardy, who is a postdoc at University of British Columbia and now a co-host of CBC's science TV show Project X, which, by the way, you can watch online without commercials streaming into your computer by checking out www.cbc.ca/Project X. So there's lots of great shows to be seen there and more to come. Music-wise, you just heard Modest Mouse and Float On. And following that, I played the band that just so happens to be the favorite band of our interviewee and Jennifer Gardy. And that band is Bend Sinister, and the song that you heard was Truth or Truth. And so I've got a little bit more from my conversation with Jennifer. And in the second clip, we chatted about the making of Project X and how that happens, about her adventures around the world pursuing some of these science stories, and also a little bit of a preview of some of the upcoming highlights for Project X on CBC. So check this out.
Basically, the premise for the pilot had been decided. They knew they wanted to do protective armor as a theme, and so they talked to the hosts and they said, are there any stories from your field of biology or engineering or microbiology that might be relevant to the episode? So we gave them a few ideas, and then their research team basically went out and found a few. And that's how it ended up going for the 7 other episodes that we ended up making, too. We were basically all put in a room together once we got the go-ahead for the show and told to not come out until we had picked the general themes for the remaining 7 episodes and come up with some vague ideas about what the stories we might touch on are. So we do get input at that stage, and then after that point, it basically goes into the production team's hands, and they go out. And they're really looking for interesting stories and interesting characters that we can go find and interview and film. So they do a lot of research, bring back a whole bunch of stuff, put a script together, because they figure out between the producers and the directors, you know, what are the key bits of science that they want to communicate, because each segment is only 6 to 7 minutes long. You really just have to pick 2 or 3 key points that you want to get across. And sometimes they want to tell a story that spans all 3 segments, so that kind of guides their choices as well. But once they've got a script together, it goes back to us. We look for any glaring scientific inaccuracies that we can spot, offer any input, and then we just go out and shoot it.
It's taking you all around the world, it seems. Or is that a fiction created by the television?
It actually did take us all the way around the world. I think the initial idea, they wanted to kind of keep the budget down, keep it a nice little production, but they realized that you can't tell all the stories in a studio set. You know, you can't really do 2 studio things in 1 location shoot per show. It's really best to have each segment have some sort of location component, and then maybe some studio component on top of that. For Brian Alter's segments, he hosts The Natural World. He deals with all the flora and fauna and things. It's kind of hard to do studio stuff for that, so he's basically in the field all the time. But for my segments and the engineering stuff, it's a real mix of in Toronto on a soundstage or out in the world. So for the most part, we try and stick within Canada and North America. It's definitely preferable to tell Canadian stories on Canadian television, but if the story's in the States, we go there. And there have been a few times where we've gone abroad to tell an interesting story, There's two segments that were shot in London, England. One is for the memory episode, and that was really fun. I got to do that one. It was running around with the guys that do parkour and free running.
Oh my goodness, I'm so jealous.
They're so cool. They're amazing. Like, they're basically the biggest parkour crew in the world, and anytime you see parkour in a commercial, in a movie, like the beginning of Casino Royale, that was one of their guys that was hired to do that. So we were looking at them and the idea of muscle memory and how if you practice in a gym over and over these repetitive movements like very precise jumping and landing and rolling, when you get out into a brand new urban environment and you're just running around, you can trust your body not to get injured and to make the jumps and land the leaps and things. And we also told a story there, it was Brian Alter's segment in the Speed episode, where he went to, I think it's Walthamstow, is the greyhound racing track in the East End of London, and they looked at how greyhounds run, basically, in this veterinary clinic where they have little greyhounds running on treadmills all day long. And then, yeah, in last week's episode, Invasive Species, we went down to Mexico to look at tapeworms, which was rather exotic. So I have gotten to see the world, thanks to CBC. Thanks, taxpayers.
So, of the episodes that are still to come, is there one that you're in favor of more than the others?
I think definitely the memory one is a very, very cool one. And I think the memory one's great, too, because, well, a lot of the other things, you know, light and flight, are things that we all have an idea of. Memory is something that every single person has experience with. You know, we all have the memory. Some of ours work better than others, but it's something we can all relate to. So I think it's an interesting episode just for that reason. It's very relatable. But then, yeah, we do this great story about muscle memory and aspects of memory that you don't really think of. And I also had great fun with the Speed episode. In that segment, I'm looking at the differences between essentially marathon runners and sprinters, and what is it about the human body that helps us to run really quickly. So we went down to Houston for that, and we were in it's a kinesiology lab, and they study the gait of sprinters down there. So they have this massive treadmill, bigger than any treadmill I've ever seen, with harnesses and all the sorts of safety equipment hooked up to it. And they use it to measure basically really high-speed running. So they put sprinters on it, and not that particular treadmill, but its predecessor, they would run flightless birds and all sorts of, like, elephants and just crazy jungle animals on this thing. So in that episode, I go on the treadmill, and a champion sprinter goes on the treadmill, and we look at the differences between Slowpoke here and Speedy Gonzalez.
What did you discover? What did you learn?
Well, I don't want to give too much away, but what's really interesting is that my gait and the sprinter's gait have a lot more in common than you might think. You know, if you stop and think about why does a sprinter go faster than just Joe Blow that's running, you might come up with maybe a list of five different things just intuitively, and it turns out that most of the things you think might make a difference don't. It's only a very small number of factors that actually cause one person to run, you know, twice the speed of another. So you'll have to stay tuned to find out.
That was almost a song, but actually what you just heard was Jennifer Gardy chatting about the making of Project X and some of the upcoming show highlights. I really enjoyed my chat with her, and she's definitely a rising star as a science television host that you can keep watching and keep an eye out on Project X. I mentioned the website a moment ago, but I'll just repeat it again. All the episodes of Project X are posted online at www.cbc.ca/Project X. And as I mentioned a moment ago, Bend Sinister happens to be the favorite band of Jennifer Gardy, and at her request, I shall play Time Breaks Down.
Stop thinking about the TV war. I know it. it's hard, but you can't complain now, girl. 'Cause you need someone to latch you in. On a secret I've been keeping for a thousand years, a secret keeping me from a thousand tears and a hope, girl. If I tell you what it is, you keep it safe and sound, make sure no one else around knows that time breaks down. Leave it on your own two feet. Don't you know the time breaks down? Leave it on your own two feet. Leave it on your own two feet. Leave it on your own two feet. Well, it's just as easy as one, two, three. But the only ones that know, babe, are you and me. So let's make a pact to hide the fact now, girl. So keep it safe and sound and make sure no one else around knows that time breaks down. Share our secrets.
Heard Time Breaks Down by Ben Sinister, the favorite band of Jennifer Gardy, who joined us on just last week for a pre-recorded interview about Project X and her role as co-host there. Now, as always, we've got a handful of science events that you keen scientists out there just might be interested in hearing about. So I'll kick it off with a personal favorite, the Café Scientifique events. I'm not going to be shy to tell you that the reason it's a personal favorite is because I'm one of the organizers of those events. But that's Café Scientifique in Vancouver, and the next event is on March 25th at the Railway Club. It's a free event, and it begins at 7:30 p.m. This particular event will feature Dr. Cheryl Wellington, who is a researcher at UBC at the CMMT, or the Center for Molecular Medicine and Therapeutics. Her featured talk will be entitled The Early Bird Remembers the Worm, a discussion on the origins of Alzheimer's disease. And Dr. Wellington is an expert on Alzheimer's disease and also on the aging brain. So that should be a great evening with lots of discussion as well. CIHR actually has been lending some of its financial backing to these sorts of cafe style events. And this one doesn't actually fall under my organizational work, but there is a CIHR sponsored Café Scientifique on March 12th at 7 p.m. at Steamworks in Gastown. It's being run by a group out of UBC, and the theme of their event is Building a Healthy City, a discussion on cycling, air quality, and noise in Vancouver. And they've assembled a panel of researchers who can speak about everything from health, infrastructure, air pollution, policy, and so on, all relating to cycling and building the healthy city. Many of you may also be aware that Celebrate Research Week is going on right now at UBC. For more information about that, you should check out www.celebrateresearch.ubc.ca, because there are tons of events going on over the next week, including a heap of events tomorrow and on Saturday that you might be interested in. For example, on Saturday, there is an event called Current Topics in Diabetes Research, and that's at the Irving K. Barber Learning Center here on campus at 1961 East Mall. That'll take place from 1:30 p.m. to 3:30 p.m., and it's a session open to graduate students and researchers featuring keynote speakers, trainee presentations, and so on. So that's Current Topics in Diabetes Research. An open public forum that looks really great to me is called Diabetes Genes or Lifestyle, and no doubt it will attempt to look at the question whether diabetes is a genetic disorder or one caused by more environmental factors such as lifestyle, or indeed a combination of the two, which is most likely. And that is on Saturday morning from 10 to 12 p.m. at the Victoria Learning Theatre, again at the Irving K. Barber Learning Center, 1961 East Mall. And finally, I saw there's a day-long research day on protein misfolding diseases. So that's the kind of things that include mad cow's disease. So definitely topical, and takes place from 8:30 to 2:15 on Saturday also, and that'll be at the IRC Lecture Theatre 4 in the Woodward Building. As I mentioned before, all these events and many, 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 many more are being organized through UBC's Celebrate Research Week, and you can find out more about that by going to www.celebrateresearch.ubc.ca. Now, March 14th, which is just a week away, is Pi Day. In other words, using the clumsy American date system of 314, or you get pi, 3.14. So March 14th is Pi Day. And if you want to get picky about it, you could do something on March 14th at 1:59:26 p.m. in order to honor pi, or to even more pi to even more decimal places. That's 3.14159.26, and on and on and on. It also happens to be Albert Einstein's birthday, so really you have no excuse not to party on that day. Pi and Einstein all in one go. I have not been able to figure out if there are any pi parties in Vancouver, but you can be sure I'll be having a word with the Pi R Squared pizza folks downstairs to make sure that they're celebrating properly. And here is a tune by Kate Bush in which pi is stated to many decimal places to music. Really incredible. This is Pi by Kate Bush.
Oh,
can hear in the background is Kate Bush's song, Pie. Full of all kinds of great lyrics, including pie, stated to something more than 10 decimal points or something wild like that. And I've just played it to encourage you to get out and celebrate Pi Day on March 14th. That's the third month, 14th day, 3.14 equals Pi. But tomorrow, which is Friday, at CITR, there's going to be a rich day of programming on women's issues as it's International Women's Day. Today's not Friday, but having just interviewed pro science communicator Jennifer Gardy, and being one of two female hosts of a science radio show, that's this one, I wanted to revisit the notion that women may be better at language and communication than men. And this definitely hit it big in the news recently when Luann Brizendine published a book called The Female Brain. And she made a pretty huge claim in that book that caught a lot of attention, and it's been repeated in a number of places and challenged in many, many more than that. But the claim that she made was that women used about 20,000 words per day, and at 20,000 words per day, women were using nearly three times more than a man's average per day, which was about 7,000 words. Brizendine's book made quite a splash because it was full of scientific errors, scientific inaccuracies, and really a misstatement of the general understanding of science in that field. It even won a Becky Award, and a Becky Award is actually, I just learned, it's named for a 16th century physician who argued that the language of the Garden of Eden was clearly Flemish. And I forget his name off the top of my head, but it was something like Beckerus or something like this, and so the Becky Awards have been named in his honor, and they're given for the single most ridiculous or misleading bit of linguistic nonsense that somebody manages to put over in the media. And for her claims about men and women and their use of words per day, Luann Brizendine got that award. But recently there's been an article published in Science that challenges these statistics. And it was published by a researcher by the name of James Pennebaker. And it was published in Science magazine, which is, as you probably know, one of the top academic publishing spaces. And Pennebaker worked for many years with post-traumatic stress patients, and there he began to recognize that there was a deficiency in people's self-reporting of their experiences. And so he wanted to devise a strategy for measuring normal levels of talk and reporting. And in order to do this, he developed a small portable recording device that would record short or 30-second samples of ambient noise if nobody was speaking or conversation. And it recorded 30-second samples every 12.5 minutes, on and on and on it went. The device could not be tampered with by the carriers. And so these devices were used to collect chatter patterns of nearly 400 university students, about 200 males and 200 females, in three places, in Texas, Arizona, and Mexico. And then armed with all this data, no doubt hundreds of portable recording devices with bazillions of short 30-second samples, Pennebaker set about calculating chatter rates. The researchers made one big assumption, and that assumption was that each individual was asleep for 7 hours a day. And I suppose partnered with that is the assumption that these individuals did not talk in their sleep. In any case, in most cases, the average number of words spoken by men and women were about the same. The males studied, though, had the widest variation in their words spoken per day, with both the most economical speaker using only 500 words and the wordiest using a whopping 47,000 a day. But in comparing the genders, both men and women appeared to use approximately similar amounts of words per day. Women came in at about 16,215 per day on average, and men at 15,669, so scarcely separated by more than 500 words per day. And running a bit of statistical analysis on this, the conclusion was that there was no significant difference. But still the question remains, is there a biological source for these presumed differences in language ability? And there's been another publication by Doug Berman, who is a research associate at Northwestern University, and he's in their communication department. And he recently published in a paper in the journal Neurophysiologica that shed some light on the biological source of gender differences in language. Unsurprisingly, the study relied heavily on functional magnetic resonance imaging of the brain. The researchers gathered two groups of children, 31 boys and 31 girls, ranging in age from 7 to 15 years. And while the children were undergoing MRI scanning, the children were asked to perform language-based tasks. In these tasks, two words were either spoken to the children or flashed in front of their eyes. And then they were asked to determine one of a couple of things about those words. One, were those words spelt similarly? For example, line and pine. Are those words spelt similarly? And yes, they are. Another task was to determine whether words rhyme. Perhaps they would be shown the words pint and mint, although looking as though they should rhyme, they actually don't when spoken, in contrast to gate and hate. Of course, some unrelated words like jazz and list or what have you were thrown in as controls. This research team found that there was more activity in the so-called language areas of the girls' brains than that of the boys. Regions implicating in decoding heard words, speech processing, and spelling and meaning were studied. In the girls, activity in speech processing regions and regions implicated in spelling and meaning seemed to correlate with greater accuracy on the tests. And sort of the takeaway conclusion from this is that this suggests that girls can process words more abstractly, and it didn't matter whether those words were spoken or read. Boys, on the other hand, showed activity in regions tied to visual and auditory functions according to whether those words were spoken or read. So in other words, depending on the way that they were presented. This suggests not only a biological difference in early processing of language, but it can also be applied to teaching styles, suggesting that this information could allow us to better adapt features of teaching for different genders. For example, boys may need to be taught with both a textbook and oral approaches, while girls may be able to pick up concepts more abstractly or more generally by either method. Now, this is a little bit off the beaten path, but I came across some research done by a lab called the Laugh Lab, and it was done way back in 2002, and it was analyzing jokes, and it was clearly kind of hilarious in and of itself, never mind the jokes that they were analyzing. And this team was led by psychologist Richard Wiseman, and he conducted a study to find the funniest joke and to find out what kinds of jokes people enjoyed. And to do this, they solicited jokes from around the world. Sadly, a number of the jokes had to be excluded for rude or offensive language, because these jokes had to be repeatable to someone as young as 10 years old. Nevertheless, they collected 40,000 entries of jokes and humor from around the world, and people evaluated those jokes on a 5-point scale. The study revealed numerous cultural differences, such as us North American folks, we generally apparently prefer jokes that involve someone else looking stupid, whereas in Australia, New Zealand, UK, and Ireland, these cultures prefer jokes that base around words. Many European countries preferred surreal jokes, and verbal joke-telling was just all but absent in Japan. They found that Germans gave the highest ratings overall to jokes and seemed to appreciate all kinds of jokes, those jovial Germans. And one rather amusing factual tidbit to take away from these studies is that they have clearly identified the funniest animal going, and the funniest animal is the duck. So if you ever want to make people laugh, if you've got a joke, go with a duck joke. To find out more about these studies, check out www.laughlab.co.uk. It's good for a giggle, and I think even the funniest joke is posted there. Coming up next is Darren and Stereoscopic Readout, which will be a great show this evening. Stick around for that. And in 2 weeks' time, Julia will join you with her collection of scientific oddities and good times. So thanks for listening to my science project. Here's another Modest Mouse tune, Never Ending Math Equation.